What began as a drug rehabilitation program soon transformed into a controversial community. Its unconventional methods gained nationwide coverage, attracting celebrity interest and political support. But over time, its boisterous leader shifted the group's focus toward profit-making endeavors to fund his vision for a utopian society. This week's episode is The Cult of Synanon, Part 1.
A bump in the night, your heart fills with dread. Probably a murderer who wants you dead. It could be a ghost, a demon, or worse. Perhaps you're the victim of a witch's curse. It's hopeless, you're doomed, you'd call a priest if you could. You'd rather just listen to who? Sinisterhood.
I'm gonna kill you.
Well, today's the first day of the rest of your life.
I tell myself that every day when I wake up and look in the morning. Wake up and look in the morning, the mirror. And that's how my week's been going. I feel like I've lived a lifetime in the past week. I don't know why.
Been 2 days.
It seems like so. I know. It's so. See, I didn't even realize today's Tuesday.
Yeah. Well, the eclipse changes things.
It must have been the eclipse.
Well, shout out if anyone was in the path of totality. We were some 99%ers down here. It was like pretty close to all the way. I was like, I'm not driving anywhere. Although people that said they were in 100% zones, they were like, it was so different. But
really?
Yeah. I thought it was
pretty 100% here, but
it was
pretty dark.
Especially,
I mean, we just went out into our front yard. Mm-hmm. Which, it was awesome, though. Like, the stillness right before, and just how, and I had read how, like, birds and animals, like, think it's nighttime, so they'll start, like, acting different, and so you really did, and then, like, the streetlights came on.
Yeah!
And the temperature dropped, like, so much. I was like, can we just stay like this?
Yeah, it was
for
nice.
Hours? Now, I wanted to come back, because I know that we need the sun. We're not trying to have an ice age situation.
No.
But just like a couple of hours experiencing that would have been very cool. And the videos from downtown Dallas of people like up high on hotel balconies and getting that vantage point of like the whole downtown just going dark
in the middle of the day.
I told Tommy, I was like, I didn't want to deal with the crowds, but I do wish that we had seen it from like a higher up perspective to like kind of get the gravity of it all.
Right, because I was like, oh, being on the ground, I'm looking up. We had, like, recliner. We have, like, lounge chairs in our backyard that Paris was like, no worries. I got the hornet's nest out of it. That's how often we use it. So he's a champ. He, like, cleaned the backyard so that we could chill back there. But, yeah, I didn't know that it would – I mean, it makes sense that it would be such a different vantage point, that would be kind of an advantage to be up high. But we, I mean, I thought it was cool. And we were both like, of course, that if that happened in the year 1500, you would be like, God has abandoned us.
Oh,
and
dude.
He's back like 3 minutes later.
It's over. Yeah. And then, when it went away, you're like, what do we do now? We just sacrificed half of our tribe.
Like, oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was super cool. And
badass.
I hope that everybody got to experience at least a little bit of it.
Yeah, some of it, or see it on streaming, or see like some of the pictures NASA has put out. And there's no shortage of eclipse conspiracies, eclipse-spiracies out there. And that was I got on two TikTok algorithms related to the eclipse. One I loved, and it was indigenous beliefs and cultural beliefs around the eclipse, which gave me a lot to think about, like as it was going on, of like the concept that the sun is a life giver. And while it's gone, you should take a moment to be grateful. And then there were people that were like, CERN is firing off rockets. Obama told him to. And it's like, all right. CERN, it's this. It's part of the deep state conspiracy. I think in real life, it's a laboratory that helps, that is trying to do like particle physics and like split the atom. But in conspiracy land, they're trying to tear a hole in the fabric of space time so that the elite cabal can time travel. And I don't even know the rest of it.
Well, I mean, if you split the atom and all that, you might accidentally just rip the fabric of space-time. Now, whether or not you want to then let the Illuminati through, that's up to you. So you got a judgment call to make at that point.
It's funny you say that. That's definitely one of the conspiracies, is that in 2012 or 2016 that they accidentally ripped a hole in our fabric of space-time, and that's why shit's been fucked since then. Although, I recognize the irony discussing this, wearing a Denver Airport Illuminati shirt is a joke. I don't really believe it. I just thought it would be funny.
I like the shirt. It's very nice.
Shout out,
Etsy. I'm only on the Eclipse algorithm of just people showing videos and screaming wildly while they're taking it, like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And it really is. We could hear, like, the schools around here cheering. And I was like, this is, it's one of those things where you're like, everybody is kind of watching this right now. So you feel like you're all taking place in this, like, unifying activity. And those are always very bonding. We're outside. I've met some new neighbors. Never met before. Yeah. So Simon, one of our neighbors, had this big tub of water, and they were like, this is how they looked at them in the olden days. And Simon just proceeded to play in it and throw rocks in it. So nice. That was good for him.
Because like, we were like,
buddy, you can't look up at the sky if you don't have your little glasses on.
That is a concern. Every time I saw school children, I was like, good, how bless the teachers out there that are like, leave the glasses on, don't take them off. Because I took mine off, and that didn't go well.
Once it got to like mostly totality, I think you can. At least
this
I did.
This is like 12:45. I looked up, I was like, that looks crazy. Lift glasses. Ah!
Oh, like, yeah, yeah. One of my neighbors kept taking hers off, and bold. I was like, well, this Hank Green like made this whole TikTok about how it was going to be like the most dangerous eclipse ever because so many people will be looking up at it and you don't realize how easily your retinas can burn. And that's like a forever thing. Yeah. Like you just have like a black spot in your eye, which would be very annoying.
It was so. The guy on the news was like, we want you all to remember this as a day that you spent with your families, not because you have to think about it every day because you have a spot on your eye from staring at it. And I was like, sounds good. And then went outside and immediately did it. I was like, I just, you know, it was, I wasn't even thinking, but the rest of the time I wore my glasses and I'm all good and I can still see.
I think the kiddos, they have them, they tape them to a paper plate.
Do that.
And then like put it around their head. So like
rubber band.
They can't just take them off. Yeah. Yeah, they're kind of, it's like a fun thing and they decorate them and
for
stuff.
Your
you
own
gotta
safety.
Figure out something. And it sounds like maybe you need that next
year.
Yeah,
I should have. I should have, absolutely.
It's not happening again in our lifetime.
I think I have 2044. I have 20 years to learn my lesson. But if you all want to, you can look at us just raw. You don't need any special glasses to see our eclipses on stage for the full moon energy tour.
Yeah, look straight our full at moons. Us. We drop our pants halfway through the show. And it's always at a different time. So even if you've been before, you're like, okay, here's where they moon everyone. Mm-mm. We're not. We mix it up to keep you on your toes.
Yeah, even if you think you know, you have no idea. But if you don't know what we're talking about, you probably do. You listen, but you're going to hear it again. The Full Moon Energy Tour is our comedy show. We're taking on the road. It's all about the darker side of the moon, what it does to us, what lurks up there, the fucking time zone. We're going to add that to it. There's a time zone on the moon, and what people really think happened during the Apollo missions. Aliens. So from legend to lore and the mysterious and the macabre, we just bring everything together in one moon-centered fun night. So bring a friend. If a friend doesn't even listen to podcasts, but they live under the moon, anyone can like the show.
Yeah, and that means everybody.
Yes.
Everyone on this planet can come to this show and learn something about something we all rely on every day.
We do.
But especially if you're in St. Louis, Chicago, Milwaukee, Charlotte, Raleigh, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Toronto, Kansas City, Oklahoma City, San Diego, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Dallas. And then TBD on perhaps a few other cities. We're figuring that out right now. But for now, these are for sure. And you can go to sinisterhood.com/live shows for all the information on dates, times, venues, and more.
Well, as today is the first day of our life, the man who coined that phrase, it's the first day of all y'all's life if you don't know about the person we're about to talk about today.
I was impressed that he coined the phrase, today is the first day of the rest. I mean, that's a colloquialism that most people know and have heard of, but it wasn't invented that long ago. And also, I never know like where those things come from. You kind of just are like, I don't know, it's always been around. So it's interesting when you're like, well, that's how we got that.
You're like, that guy? Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd never heard of this. And all of a sudden, there's a documentary on Max, a docuseries. The first episode's out. It's a four-parter. And there's also one on Paramount Plus.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I think two of the Max have come out. I haven't.
Two of now.
Part of way through the second one, but we're going to talk about more of that stuff in future parts. So, a book came out in 2020 from the lead singer of the Airborne Toxic Event band, as he was raised in this group. And so it's called Hollywood Park. So I've been listening to that. He's very poetic. So if you ever want to, if you want a lighter, not lighter side, but a beautifully written cult memoir. He's a lyricist, so his work is phenomenal. But this group, it's giving echoes of many groups we've seen, but it's like different than I've ever. It's just like where it just takes left turns, right? You're like, okay, all right, we're doing that now.
It has a lot of the cult 101 beginnings. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There are some surprises that we'll talk about throughout well. Well, I'm Christy.
And I'm Heather.
And let's get into it. Charles Diedrich was born March 22, 1913 in Toledo, Ohio, to parents Charles Sr. and Agnes Kuntz, a classical concert singer. Although named after his father, Jr. went by his nickname, Chuck, throughout his life. From an early age, Chuck faced tragic hardships and losses. His father, who struggled with alcoholism, died in a car accident when the young boy was just 4 years old. 4 years later, when Chuck was eight, he suffered another devastating loss when his youngest brother died from influenza. When Chuck was 12, his mom remarried. He didn't mince words when it came to how he felt about his stepfather, telling one publication that he
loathed
the man. Still, his mother's new maid had a significant hand in a major life transformation for Chuck. While she tried to raise her son as a devout Catholic, the religious teachings didn't resonate with him. 14 years old, Chuck found his stepfather's copy of The Outline of History by H.G. Wells, later telling the New York Times that after reading it, he
became a militant atheist almost overnight.
Have you ever read a book that quickly changed your life, like a whole worldview overnight?
Not religiously, but it's funny you say that. When I was like this age, when I was in middle school, I think I've said it before on there, the book Tooth Imprints on a Corn Dog by Mark Lerner was in.
I've never heard you mention this one.
I haven't. I thought I have. Maybe I haven't. It's called Tooth Imprints on a Corn Dog. Tooth imprints, like the imprints of one's tooth. Yeah,
gotcha. That made more sense. Okay.
And it was in a collection of like absurdist essays that were parodies of like New Yorker essays. But I didn't know that at the time. I just thought they were like outrageous and funny as fuck. And I was like, you could just like write stuff like this. Mm. And I was like, pfft. And it was also around that time that I discovered David Sedaris books. Mm-hmm. So both of those, I was like, oh, I was writing kind of like, I thought you had to be like once upon a time, like if you were going to write a story. And then it was like, you can just write a fun, weird essay. And that was very like the switch just flipped in my head. So I can see how at that age, like you're just like, God damn it, I have to go to mass again. And then you get this book and you're like, now, wait a minute.
It's an impressionable age, especially, suffering such huge losses by the time you're 14. I imagine you're searching a lot of places for something that kind of sticks with you, that resonates with you. So if that can come from a book, that's great.
In the 1920s, you know, it's people are just telling you everything happens for a reason. Yeah. And you're not being like, hey, let's process the trauma of the loss of your dad and your little brother in such a short time frame. You're just like, well, if God is real, he's an asshole because he took my family from me and not like analyzing what happened and why it happened and all that. So I can see how you would just be looking for something, an alternative explanation to what's being like forced on you.
For sure. And thus begins his decades of what he calls, quote, bottled up rage.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is what happens when we don't talk about our feelings.
Mm-hmm. They don't go away. It's just like shaking a can. No,
and you're right. Back then, that wasn't heard of. You know, I mean, nobody talks about
it. You went to church.
Yeah, you went to church. Yeah, exactly. You prayed for it. Mm-hmm. After already having endured a lifetime of pain by the age of 14, Chuck began turning to alcohol. His drinking escalated during his high school years, and Chuck was already struggling with addiction when he graduated. Having been accepted into the prestigious University of Notre Dame, Chuck attended, but dropped out after only 18 months due to poor grades and his continuing battles with alcohol. When Chuck was 29 years old, he was faced with hardship once again after he contracted meningitis. He survived the often terminal infection, but was left with permanent drooping on the right side of his face, a disfigurement that left him feeling like even more of an outcast.
Yeah, his eye was permanently half closed, and they also said the whole right side of his face would be constantly kind of twitching, which I imagine, I mean, that's just like chronic pain that you're now left with, in addition to kind of how badly people, not just back then, but I mean, I think it's gotten better now, but any difference in your appearance, you were treated much worse back then.
Yeah, and if you're already struggling with an addiction and then something like that happens, that's going to send you into a tailspin. I went to college with a guy who got meningitis from an airplane.
Oh, wow. God.
On the way to his grandfather's funeral. Like, what a bitch.
And Jesus.
Then he got back and, like, he couldn't look down. Like, that intense neck pain that everyone says is kind of like the beginning. Mm-hmm. And he was in the hospital for quite a while. And that was in, like, late 90s. So, I mean, this was way before that, and when the medical stuff wasn't nearly as good. So something like that could have easily taken him out, especially with already being in poor health, but he survived it.
Yeah, and like you said, just being, he was a social, he said, you know, he drank a lot, but more, it was more socially and for fun. And then after that mastoidectomy, it was like you said, just numbing the pain, like,
yeah,
all the time.
By the late 1950s, he was drinking heavily and working at Gulf Oil in sales and public relations. In the book, The Tunnel Back, Chuck said he
roared up and down the countryside drunk for 20 years.
It wasn't until around 15 years later that things started looking up for him. On May 14th, 1956, Chuck attended his first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He was 43 years old and had been living in Santa Monica, California for the past 3 years, his marriage crumbling because of his addiction. Indeed, this was the second marriage for Chuck, his first one having also fallen apart because of his excessive drinking, leaving his children, a son, Chuck Jr., nicknamed Didi, and daughter Cecilia Jason, nicknamed JD, to live with their respective mothers.
Yeah, and I think it was the second wife that was kind of like, you got to do something, just go to a meeting, at least just show me you're making some progress.
And then she was tragically killed, which is a whole other story.
Yeah, I mean, they divorced.
Another ex-husband. So that's kind of when her daughter or when their daughter went to live with Chuck later. But yeah, just so much tragedy in
surrounding
one family. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the daughter was 10 at the time and was there when it occurred outside of a doctor's office and was kind of forced to tell police what happened. And so she tried to do right by Chuck, but I think rightfully so, was like, you're not really working the program. Like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah. Immediately, Chuck took to the program, telling psychiatrist and author Daniel Castriel,
"That's all I did. I was the first one to speak, and I'd speak all night unless they stopped me."
Chuck diligently attended multiple meetings per week and sponsored other members to help them get clean. Eventually, though, Chuck began attending meetings less and less. He was barely getting by on his $33 a week unemployment checks, and the religious aspect of AA didn't resonate with him. Chuck's daughter from his second marriage, J.D. Diederich Montgomery, told filmmakers for the Max docuseries, The Synanon Fix, Did the Cure Become a Cult?, that AA
just wasn't deep enough
for her dad.
And also, I'm suspicious of him working the program in this way, where he's not saying, I wanted to listen, I wanted to be a part of it. He's like, I talked the whole time. I talked all night. And another member who, so he was in AA with some people, and then, you know, like they later on followed him. And one of the women that followed him kind of said, yeah, in those AA meetings, he was boisterous, he was obnoxious, and he would frequently come with a woman on each arm. The term she used was bimbos. But that he was kind of like, to me, he gives P.T. Barnum vibes, like all around. Yeah. I always get a feeling he's trying to sell me something. Everything feels like He's crafting a story for the purposes of selling and pushing a narrative to somehow benefit him, either morally or financially. And the same, he'll talk to like interviewers and be like, AA was everything. It was my life. I was there every single night. And people are like, yeah, monologuing. Like,
yeah, like grandstanding, which that's not the platform. If you want that, then go become a minister or something where you have a congregation that's there. But AA and programs of that nature, the whole, one of the best things about it is like that community feeling where like everyone is sharing and you learn from each other and corroborate. You learn from each other and commiserate with like similar things you've gone through. So if you have one person that's just leading the whole thing and nobody else gets a word in, first of all, we're watching a season of Traitors right now that has a person like this on it that just will not shut up, no matter who they're talking to, interrupts everybody, like nobody can ever get a word in, and I can't stand him. I hope he gets murdered in the show. But that's how this guy is too. It's like he liked to hear himself talk, and he really liked when other people listened to him talk.
Oh yeah, I mean, people would always go, well, one of the sociologists that wrote the book The Tunnel Back wrote the book. In the book, he goes, and Chuck signed off on everything in this. I was like, I ordered this book from 1965. I was like, okay, it's like an early analysis. And I was like, oh, this is propaganda. Great. But in it, he's like, Chuck defies description in capsule form. And then the next sentence, he was like, he was arrogant. He was hostile. He was like, I was like, okay, well, there he is. He's like, he was 5'10", 240 pounds, and he yelled at people. And I was like, that's a capsule. You did it. You did it.
He looked like he could be a tough guy. He, you know, always, even before the meningitis, he just had this look about him like he was kind of like a bulldog. Like he would just very tenacious and always smoking a cigarette. So he's always kind of, you know, got this like gruffness about him. A lot of times he's in overalls, which I guess was a fashion thing back then because there's a lot of overalls in this documentary.
He got obsessed with overalls and they sort of became mandatory later, but for his people, it's sort of, and we'll see as we go, it's like at all times the group becomes a reflection of him with the smoking, with the overalls, with the attitude of screaming and the bottled up rage. But if I was going to cast him, I would say rough up Nick Offerman and give him like a crew cut. And I think he would do well in like if they were going to do a movie version of this.
Yeah.
It would. Nick Offerman is sweet, has 0% personality similarities with this guy, but physically kind of has kind of like stocky build, like could, it looks like he was maybe could have been ex-military or something with the crew cut haircut and a lot of screaming.
Yeah, yeah.
Sinister Hood will be right back.
I'll tell you what, kids grow real fast and it's just a real beating when you buy them a whole set of clothes and then before they can even make their way through it, they've already outgrown it.
I always wondered that. I'm like, how do you even know if they're going to be able to wear this in a few months?
Sometimes and now they're not.
Damn
sometimes
it.
Sometimes they can't. I know. But if you get clothes that will stretch with your kid as they grow, like Posh Peanuts clothes that are made from bamboo and are 4 times stretchier than cotton, then they're made to last. They're loved by parents and approved by kids, and you won't have to be replacing them before they even get to wear it.
That's why you got to get with Posh Peanut. They make beautifully crafted, thoughtful, wonderful, stylish clothing for kids and families designed in-house. Their pieces are made with ridiculously soft viscose from bamboo that stays soft even after you wash them over and over again.
Posh Peanut is loved by over 1 million parents and also adored by all your favorite celebrities and influencers. We can't say their names, but if you know, you know.
I'm just going to say it. Christy Wallace. Heather McKinney. But also, you know, real celebrities. And Posh Peanut is made for infants and kids, but they also have sizing for moms and dads if you want the whole family to match, which I know a lot of y'all do with your cute pictures. I love seeing y'all with your peanuts matching. And if you're not a parent, consider this the perfect gift for any little one. I know I do because I get anxiety buying gifts. I'm not a mom. And I'm always like, how do you know what size kids are? What are they allowed to wear? I don't know. Posh Peanut solved all my problems.
It's got it. Right now, Posh Peanut is offering our listeners 20% off your first order with promo code CREEPY. Go to poshpeanut.com/creepy and use promo code CREEPY for 20% off your first order.
That's poshpeanut.com/creepy, promo code CREEPY.
Having achieved the major milestone of 1 year sober and longing for a deeper connection, Chuck decided to enroll as a participant in an experiment at UCLA in 1957. The first of its kind experiment was testing LSD as a cure for alcoholism. Profoundly impacted by the study, Chek later told an oral historian in 1962 that it was
the most important single experience of my entire life.
Chek explained how using the drug was a breakthrough moment for him, unlocking a confidence in himself he had never felt before.
I became a different person, really and truly. Everything that has happened to me since, Synanon, everything, dates from that point.
If I was one of his kids and I heard him say that the most important single experience of my entire life was when I dropped acid in an experiment at UCLA, that would sting a bit.
It's a little painful.
But I'm glad that it worked out. This is a whole other subset of things that we can't like even dig into all of it. But people just did all sorts of shit back then. Like these kind of tests because like Timothy Leary and like nobody knew what the like long-term effects of stuff. Mm-mm. So if
they're like,
you know,
let's test it.
Yeah, but it's taking one drug and using it to replace another drug, and then you still run into the same problem of addictive behavior or becoming addicted to now a potentially even more harmful drug.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure if it was the test was like a one-time use and like they try to talk you through something while you're under, or if it's like, here's micro doses for, you know, however mm-hmm. long. But I do think it's not shocking, though, that the folks back at the AA group was like, oh, yeah, you can't do that. Like, no, we're sober here, man. And he's like, no, wait, listen to me. And they're like, nah.
It's a slippery slope. After the experiment, Chuck began reading everything he could get his hands on that delved into the subjects of philosophy and psychology, being especially fond of Emerson, Skinner, and Thoreau. No longer attending AA meetings, current members would stop by Chuck's apartment to check on him. Chuck used these drop-ins as a way to host his own type of meetings, waxing philosophical for hours to the small group.
There's more of that salesman shit. Like, it's reverse, though. Like, it's reverse door-to-door. You come to his door, and he sucks you in and starts selling you his new idea that's better than AA. It's like he's never not selling something.
Right? You just go over to see, like, hey, how you doing? We haven't seen you in a while. Hey. And 4 hours later, you're like, oh, guess I'll call it a night.
Yeah. It's like nothing is not a pitch meeting to him. But you know what? You're all juiced up on Henry David Thoreau. You got to dump it somewhere. And the poor schmuck from your AA group is the one that knocked on your door.
The meeting numbers began to grow, as did the intensity of discussion. JD explained to filmmakers,
my dad wasn't the kind of guy that was going to like go through all the steps and then, you know, do that for the rest of his life. There was a truth that he wanted, a kind of confrontation that he wanted. And he said, you know, I have this lifetime of bottled up rage. And he just started talking to everybody in the room like they were horrible, you know, telling them, you know, whatever kind of asshole he thought they were. And they loved it.
In the docuseries, footage of Chuck shows him explaining that
these meetings were the group process that later became known as the Synanon game.
Before the Synanon game came Synanon itself, the first residential drug addiction program of its kind in the U.S. Chuck's apartment no longer big enough to hold the meetings, he moved the group of, quote, dope fiends to a rundown storefront on Ocean Park that he rented for $100 a month. Newcomers that were struggling with addiction and wanted help would show up at the building. Here, they were treated with respect and understanding, something they rarely, if ever, received from the outside world.
Chuck wasn't the only one that liked the term dope fiend. I've found in the that Tunnel Back book, they do case studies on early residents, like from the 1959 to 1965 era. And one of them kind of pushed back. The sociologist goes, well, you know, wouldn't you rather call yourself an addict? And the guy was like, no, my addiction was so bad that there's no other word for it than fiend. Like, I was a bad person. My wife was in labor, and all I could look over was the Demerol on the tray and was thinking, how can I steal the Demerol on the tray, and then I can deal with whatever's going on with the baby. That's how bad I was. I am a dope fiend, and I will always be one, and I'm always going to be in recovery. And I was like, I'm not one to be like, you can't use that word. He's the one that was – another guy had been doing opiates since he – like, in 1920. He was, like, in his 60s by this point, and he was like – that's the only word for it. Like, I can't, that's the only thing I think about. So, but Chuck sure liked to be like, these dope fiends. And I'm like, well, it's a little different when you say it because you've never been one.
And he, even though he had an addiction with alcohol, it was kind of this weird, like, he thought he was above them because he wasn't a, quote, dope fiend. His addiction was alcohol. So he treated them in this kind of, like, childlike way. And even a lot of the younger members would call him, like, dad.
Yeah.
And stuff, which that's where it starts teetering on, okay, we're getting into real, about to be problematic territory. But it's just this weird mindset of, like, well, I'm trying to help these people, but also they're totally beneath me and, like, scum of the earth. But he's treating them better than anybody else was, and providing a place where they can, like, detox and get help and talk to other people that are going through what they're going through.
No, you're exactly right. He did treat them better than going to jail or being sent to a mental institution and locked, literally put in a straitjacket for however long the court said you had to be there. But you're right. The mom and dad thing was strange. An early woman was named Adeline Anway, and she became a board of directors member of Synanon, and her dad had been the governor of Nebraska. She had married a doctor, and her addiction to opiates was she was taking her husband's drugs out of his bag. So she looked really, like, presentable and very not like sort of the average dope fiend that was, you know, shoeless, walking down the beach with a 5 o'clock shadow, just sort of mumbling. I mean, she was a functional hype was another term that they used. And they called her mom and they called Chuck dad. And in these old articles, he would just be like, they're like infants. They come to me like babies. They lay on the couch. They can't feed themselves. They can't, like, they soil themselves. They throw up. Like, I am there for them. And then I raise them to become, our kids will grow and we will grow our kids until they can, like, become self-sufficient and leave. But you're right. It's like, there's a reason why, like, you know, mental health practitioners don't do that and, like, personalize it and be like, not just a professional can help you, but, like, I am the one to help you. I'm your dad.
Yeah. And also infantilizing someone to where, like, I mean, yes, they're soiling themselves and throwing up because they're withdrawing from these drugs, or they call it kicking it a lot. I never heard that term, but that's one that most of the people use that had gone through this. So to kind of tout yourself as, like, the person who's, you know, allowing all of this to happen and I'm the giver and the provider, well, again, that's cult 101 practices.
Yeah, that, like, I'm your life giver. And he would say, like, you're free to leave anytime. But one of the guys said, every night when he said goodnight to me, he wouldn't say goodnight to me. He would say, I'm going to say goodbye to you tonight because you won't be here in the morning. And then in the morning, he would go, oh, well, goddamn, are you still here? And the guy said, this presented a challenge to me, and I believe that I had to stay there. And I'm like, I think that we would call that negging. Like, where you're like, you're such a loser, you're probably going to leave tonight. Anyway, goodnight. And then, oh, wow, you stayed? Hmm, interesting. And it's like,
what? Very manipulative.
So much.
A lot of, like, psychological warfare that he, when you start doing that stuff, and I mean, I guess he's read these books or whatever, but when people start messing with your noodle and they don't know what they're doing, like, they don't even understand the gravity of, like, the damage that they're doing that might not ever be able to be undone.
It's the Dunning-Kruger effect in overalls is Chuck Diederich. Like, he just was like, I read enough books. I can do this. Nobody else is doing this, probably because they're stupid. I'll do it. And it's like, oh, you're not doing it. A broke clock's right twice a day. Some people, it worked. Not all of them. Not many of them.
But a lot of people loved it. And in the docuseries, a lot of people say it saved their lives. And I think for a lot, it did. That can't be discounted. For a lot, though, it hurt them and then later hurt their kids. Laying on a dingy couch in the middle of the room, residents would stay until they kicked or detoxed. There were no doctors or psychiatrists present, or medications or drugs given to help with the pain and discomfort. Rather, those addicted had to kick on their own, always surrounded by fellow Synanon members. This approach spoke to the core tenet of Synanon, that people struggling with addiction needed, quote, tough love in order to get clean and stay clean.
Yeah, they just had people watch him in, like, 6-hour shifts, and just making sure they were okay. It did throw me off at one point in that Tunnel Back book. They said they quit cold turkey with sympathy, massages, eggnog, and observation. And I was like, wait, what? God.
Oh, man. I can't ever imagine a case in which eggnog is the right answer for somebody that's violently ill.
That's what I was like. Was that a typo? No, it was not a typo.
Oh, yikes.
No. Later on, they said, yeah, they gave him eggs, pancake syrup, unless they asked for something else. But, like, that was, again, it's just a guy being like, because one person probably did well with eggnog, and he's like, well, that's the stuff. We got to give it to everybody now. Like, I think that's the problem, is that the sample sizes here of what he was doing was always so small that he'd be like, oh, it works for everybody. And you're like, you didn't, that's not how tests work.
I have heard before that, I think I ran into this working at the domestic violence shelter, because there was a woman that was detoxing from heroin, and I believe her caseworker would get chocolate for her because there was something about chocolate that, like, made some of the withdrawal symptoms a little less bad. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's something with high amounts of sugar or something that,
yeah, maybe
could help. I don't know. That's all just speculation.
Memory, yeah.
Combining the words seminar, symposium, and anonymous, one member coined the word synanon. It seemed fitting that a member was the one to name the group, given its functionality, with one former resident, Mike Gimbel, telling filmmakers for Max.
The program was addicts helping addicts. The concept was new and revolutionary.
Indeed, synanon was fundamental in helping to change the stigma surrounding people struggling with drug addiction and their ability to be helped. Not only was it free, but prior to Chuck's approach, many people in need of these services were left to die on the streets alone.
And that's what Chuck's theory was: addiction is contagious and non-addiction is contagious. So he wanted to facilitate this empathy, but he also said addicts are pathological liars. They can make a psychiatrist climb the walls, but they can't lie to us because we've been there. And so we have the answers. We invented those answers. We don't moralize and tell people they're wrong. We're just trying to help people find themselves. So he always had these, like, phrases that sounded so good and so helpful. And I can see why, like, on the surface, if the other option is, I think they said one treatment program nearby was kind of new, but it was like $500 for 5 weeks, which was so expensive at the time. So only really wealthy people could afford it. And if you're not, you just ended up in jail, a mental institution, or on the streets. And so for him to come at it with this, he's a salesman. He's selling it so great. Like, facially, all of this, you're like, good for him. Wow, he's great.
But it was also working for a lot of people. I mean, you know, at the time, it was what some people needed. And the only place where they felt accepted and they knew that they could go back, even if they, like, relapsed or, as we'll see later, they really did feel like, I got to stay here if I want to stay clean, which can often lead to another form of control. If you convince people that the only way you're ever going to stay clean is if you live here forever, which just isn't, that's not sustainable. You have families to go back to. You got jobs you got to go to and everything. So that's when you need some doctors and psychiatrists and people that know how to work these things long term and to transition from, like, one area to, like, a sober living house and then living on your own, et cetera.
But yeah, you're right. And I think the problem was he made all these claims of, like, at first it was like a 43% success rate I found in, like, 1959, but they had 52 total members. Like, it's such a small sample size. And I mean, and it also means that, like, a majority goes back to it. So it doesn't work for a majority of people. They start to change the numbers. But when you, and it was like 75% people on drugs and then 25% people just with alcohol problems. But he would just make all these claims of, like, I'm the only one doing anything and what I do works better than anything. And you're like, well, does it? Like, it statistically doesn't. Like, and it wasn't proven in a lot of cases. But it, for those people that it did help, it truly did save their lives. Multiple interviews where people are like, I would be dead. So it's, again, this, like, broke clock thing of, like, okay, well, it worked for those folks, but.
In July of 1959, an incident occurred called
the Big Cop Out,
according to the Tunnelback. Many in the group admitted to Chuck that they had been using drugs in secret. The term copping out in synanon lingo was adapted from prison culture. Members were encouraged to tell on themselves and one another, or cop out. As opposed to prison culture, this type of copping out was looked favorably upon at synanon. Chuck had impassioned and frank discussions with the members about their failings and his disappointments in them. These talks evolved into what he had first called the Synanon and later called the game.
Yeah, some guy was caught using on premises and was just going to leave. And two men like confronted him and started yelling at him. And then he's like, well, I'm not the only one using. That guy's using. And then the other person goes, well, he's using too. And they're like, well, so is that guy. And the one telling you not to leave and talking shit to you. And then it literally everyone started just screaming at each other that someone went and woke up Chuck. And he was like, we're dealing with this now. Everyone stand, like sit around in a circle. And then really just started one by one saying, okay, we're going to start with you, Kenny. You're the one that was leaving. Everybody, what's your problem? It was like a fucking Festivus. It's like an airing of grievances.
Yeah, or Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
It's and when drugs are involved and tensions are high and everyone's given just a pass to yell and say whatever they want, that is a recipe for a lot of shit that's going to start getting stirred up.
Oh, yeah. Sinisterhood will be right back.
Well, it's that time again. It's spring. It's going to be summer.
Sprung.
We're all wearing sandals. We're wearing flip-flops. We're walking around barefoot. So you got to have your toes looking on, what do the kids say these days?
Fleek brand
fleek.
Point.
Is fleek still a thing?
No, fleek's out. Fleek's been fleek's out for out. Decades.
It's Lips on me. Out too, right? I don't think so. They're just, they look great. I think great is stands the test of time. We can all just say that word forever.
Well, that's a good thing. Fleek. Lit, whatever, Olive and June is all of those things.
Their polishes last 7+ days and do not chip. Their Manny system is the ultimate secret behind salon-perfect nails at home. And they also have the Petty system that does the exact same thing. Both of them, it's a whole all-in-one complete set. It comes with everything you need. There's no guessing about what you need. You don't have to run around the house trying to find a nail file, clippers, your polish. It's all like in one contained thing, which I love. Also, no messy nails, no salon price tag. It all comes in one very attractive box. I'm going to call it an attractive box. It's very, the packaging is very pleasing.
Yeah, the Olive and June aesthetic across the Petty system and the Manny system is, it comes with the poppy, first of all, which is also part of this aesthetic. It's very clean, sharp, pink, and it makes you feel very put together. But for me, I can't be painting my hands. I can't be painting my toes with my non-dominant hand. I look like a fool. But the thing about the poppy is that it makes it so easy to paint with both of your hands. And it's like really fun to just like squish on. I don't know how to explain it. You got to get one yourself, but just make sure you get the whole Manny system. It's a game changer because you have, like Christy said, everything you need and you look sharp AF as that's people do still say that.
Do they? Okay, good. We're still hip.
Yes, it's still hip. So you got to get that Manny system with 6 polishes. It breaks down to just $2 a manicure. You can spend up to $35 for one gel manicure. Olive and June, you don't need to do all that with that.
Mm-mm. Getting beautiful salon perfect nails at home is now a dream come true with Olive and June. No more having to make appointments or travel to a salon. These, you don't gotta ask anybody for permission or work around somebody else's schedule because you got everything you need.
Right there. Visit oliveandjune.com/creepy for 20% off your first Manny system. That's oliveandjune.com/creepy for 20% off your first Manny system.
Chuck's treatment was centered around the game, a type of attack therapy that involved yelling, swearing, and expressing your deepest feelings. Players were to be completely honest, regardless of how painful it was to oneself or other participants. If someone was not being honest, they were attacked mercilessly by the group and called out for any perceived hypocrisy. Sessions were similar to AA meetings, where the participants sat in a circle. The player who was being gamed would be the target of the group's ire. Mm-mm. I don't have the thick enough skin for this. No. This isn't for me.
I'm a words of affirmation person, and by reverse, like negative words, I'm crushed. I can't.
No, yeah.
Especially, I don't do well with being yelled at either.
No,
like,
yeah.
Not at all. But that was part of it. They said basically, like, you could swear all you want during the game, but you couldn't, nobody really swore outside of it. And in fact, you could get in trouble for swearing outside of it, but you had to be in the hot seat. Like if you were going to participate in the whole Synanon deal, you couldn't be like, well, I don't really do the game part. I just do the rest of it. It was like mandatory, and it was mandatory to take your licks and be in the hot seat and get fucking screamed at and being some, once a dumped emotional garbage gets dumped out.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's just like a trauma dump session. Mm-hmm. I don't love that it's called the game either, because that just has an implication of like,
it's fun.
It's a literal game to you. Not even fun, but it's like this like mind fuck, like mm-hmm. a mind game type of thing. And none of this is a game. Addiction isn't a game. Trying to get help after addiction. Like, so it, that alone I find problematic. And then when the game is you being told you're a huge piece of shit for mm-hmm. like 20 minutes straight, but then you walk out of there feeling, honestly, I wrote down in my notes, I was like, it's like Fight Club, but with words.
Yeah.
Like people just wanted to like
wail on each other.
Yeah. And just had all this anger inside mm-hmm. of them, because talk therapy wasn't a big thing then.
Mm-mm.
Or, you know, these people are down on their luck. They can't afford stuff like that. So they have an outlet to just scream and get all this rage and anger out with no repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a rage room.
Yeah.
My only problem is in a rage room, you're like throwing plates and using hammers to bash out windows and stuff. This is directed at another human being that has feelings.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And it was brutal. It was horrible mm-hmm. to watch them
it's
do it.
It's hard to watch, yeah.
But Chuck, his argument was, you know, surgery and amputation are brutal too, but you have to do these things to get better and to heal. And so it's necessary. I would argue, I think he liked it. I think he liked screaming. And I think he got someone called it sadistic gratification. I would agree with that. He said, you have to just trust me that my motivations are pure and that I'm doing it. I'm immune to sadistic gratification. He said, probably more so now than the early days. I'm like, so you admit it. You admit it that you liked it.
Also, how is anyone immune to something?
Yeah, like he's that? Like, I guess he'd done it so much, but he's like, I don't enjoy he called it giving someone a haircut when he would holler at him, either in the game or like in person. He's like, it's really hard work to do that. I'm like, you fucking love it. You love it.
It is hard work. It is exhausting to yell at someone because it doesn't feel good for most people.
Mm-mm. No, and it doesn't feel good to
hurt
people.
That's why most of us don't do it.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the argument everyone made was like, if I can take it, because some people loved it and were like addicted mm-hmm. to it. Ironically, like they couldn't wait to go back. They couldn't wait to do these sessions.
It's that addictive personality. It's mm-hmm. not, if you have an addictive personality, it's not limited to just drugs or alcohol. I mean,
mm-mm.
that's a big scope. So yeah, you get addicted to the adrenaline rush and, mm-hmm. you know, getting like that feeling of like reared up, raring to go. You're saving up all your stuff all week for what you're going to say. Yeah. And I get it. I get how it could be helpful. I wish instead of yelling at other people, it was kind of just like yelling at an empty chair about all of yeah. the things that are going on with yourself.
A crash and not, test dummy.
Yeah. You don't have targets or not making it personal to others. Like everybody's just kind of talking about themselves.
Yeah. It was very personal. And I didn't think about this because I was like, oh, everybody just likes to yell. No one wants to be yelled at. But one of the residents said to the sociologist, Yablonsky, he said, you like to be hollered at a little bit because it makes you feel like somebody cares.
Mm.
Like if you're everyone in your family is like, I don't give a fuck about you. Go die on the streets. And then all of a sudden someone's like, come on, Jake, why aren't you just working the program? We're all here for you, man. You're kind of like, people care about me. They are all here for me. So I can see why there's because I was at first like, I'm not trying to get yelled at. But if you are kind of rock bottom, desperate for some feeling, like somebody to mm-hmm. feel something about you and you feel isolated, you probably like it.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy did, at least.
Yeah. And I mean, if you've been numb for a long time, like a breakthrough like that could be helpful for mm-hmm. some. And it definitely was. Because the crazy thing about the Max docuseries is most of it is actual footage that was from when it was going on. So seeing these recorded meetings of the game happening are wild. And I wrote down some quotes
that definitely people
were just screaming at each other. One person to another, you are a minimum daily motherfucker, which is such a roast.
That's a good one.
And then he replies, that is bullshit. And then she says, you're going to grow up, you old asshole. So, I mean, and this is
it's
like
that stuff.
Tame, kind, you know?
Yeah. At the top of their lungs, you're saying it. We're not bursting people's eardrums out. It's just like
they're screaming.
Yes.
Everyone's smoking just
constantly.
I mean, no one doesn't have a cigarette. Everyone has a cigarette at all times.
The three rules were you can't do drugs or alcohol, you can't hurt anyone physically, assault, mm-hmm. or threaten assault, and there were free cigarettes. Like, that was, like, they would be like, you can have as much cigarettes and coffee as you want.
Well, I mean, yeah. And that, again, that addiction, mm-hmm. you know, it goes in hand. One person yelled, "You cheap fucking pompous cocksucker. You fucking cheap motherfucker. This fucking guy." I got kids in the next room, so I'm trying not to scream.
No,
walk but, out. Ella's gonna be like, "Is everything okay?"
And she's like, "Hey, mom, who's a cheap motherfucker?" And you're like, "Listen, it was this guy in 1959." But it's funny because these are things that we might yell at aloud in our car alone mm-hmm. after something, you know, somebody fucks our order up or something. But to have an open door to yell that at a person, there must be a type of catharsis. I don't know.
No, I think there is. I think two truths can be mm-hmm. held at the same time. And for many, this was cathartic. And the first time they had felt these emotions mm-hmm. and they get out that bottled up rage that they've had for so long. And then others, probably there was, you know,
sadistic,
voyeuristic kind of enjoyment of getting to see other people maybe get yelled at. And some do. Like the feeling of being yelled at. I mean, even there are people that pay for that kind of stuff today. You know?
I'm not trying to kink shame here.
Yeah, but. No, I think it can and could be helpful. I just think with anything like this, there has to be regulations in place.
Professional.
So it doesn't get out of hand and then, you know, horrible shit starts happening.
No, you're right. I mean, I think for some of them, it felt good to get it out because like we said earlier, when you had trauma, it was just like, oh, I don't know, just go to church. Also, could you just not talk about it? Just get over it. Yeah. Swallow it down. And so by 1959, people are like, I've been swallowing shit for decades.
Right.
So they were ready. And this gave them that out that they needed. Yeah. But then they also did that pickup afterward where they would like talk. I mean, they were friends. Like, they're eating donuts together afterwards like having coffee.
The immediate switch from being screamed at and screaming at someone to just like, all right, and now that's over and we're all cool is something that I struggle with. Like, I'm not capable of just switching my emotions that quick, but they really, maybe that was one reason it was kind of called the game, is so it was looked at as like,
now it's
this
over.
Is a thing that we do, that we play right now, and then when it's over, we don't do that anymore. And then you have to go wait again until we play it to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The other one I had was a male member to a female member in a pretty aggressive and threatening tone was like, I want you to get honest and I'm going to demand that you get honest. You want to live around here? You want to live in Synanon? Start to play the game.
Mm-hmm. And it has that.
It was a challenge for people.
A behavioral modification as well mm-hmm. of like, you got to do this as hard as possible or we will throw you out.
Yeah, yeah. And that kind of became like a bullying thing too of like, oh, you don't want to play it? Well, we're going to kind of mm-hmm. force you. And then when the children get involved, that's when I noped out of the documentary because it is one thing to watch a bunch of adults go at each other mm-hmm.
who want to do it.
A bunch of 12-year-olds that are being forced to do it. Oh, that's just heartbreaking. And their psyches aren't made for that. That fucks mm-mm. you up.
No, yeah, they'll tell you that in their memoirs. And mm-hmm. yeah.
One technique called the carom shot allowed an attacker to mention the issues of not only the player being gamed, but also others in the circle with similar problems. Chuck encouraged pile-ons in what he called
backing the play.
The nastier, the better, as he said in Synanon Materials.
The introduction of obscenity and blasphemy into a meeting is what made the Synanon game. That was the big deal, getting that lack of inhibitions.
Everything was fair game, except physical violence.
This would be like if me and you and Tommy and Paris were playing this, and you were yelling something at me that I did, but that also Tommy or Paris did, and you'd be like yelling it at me, and you'd be like, did you hear what I just said to her, Tommy? Did you hear? Like that. So it's just like
a passive aggressive way of like, it's like when people like vague book, and it's like, who is this intended for? Because we all know that you're talking directly to one or two people with this post.
And so then just other say people, it to them. Yeah, then other people in the group would be like, yeah, Tommy, did you hear? And also, Paris, you might want to think about that as well, mm-hmm. just a little bit. And it's like, bitch, I'm just sitting here.
Everybody's catching strays.
Yes. Yeah.
Members would spend at least 3 nights per week in these so-called Synanon sessions playing the game for a total of around 30 hours per month. Chuck told a news reporter in archival footage,
"The meetings provide an emotional catharsis, an emotional release which can result in insights into the problem because the answer to the person's problem is within himself."
In Synanon literature, Chuck mused,
"The game is a big emotional dance and it's like a dream. It's random. Some dreams are nightmares. Some dreams are awfully pleasant." Sinister Hood will be right back.
Well, we all have habits we wish we could break, or even habits that we've tried again and again to stop, but we just don't have any luck doing it.
No, sometimes it's easier to replace a habit with a new, less dangerous, or more healthy habit. I like that phrase, a nail drives out another nail. You need something to kind of help you get past it.
Today, we're talking about our sponsor, Fume, and they look at the problem in a different way. Not everything in a bad habit is wrong, so instead of a drastic, uncomfortable change, why not just remove the bad from your habit?
Fume is an innovative, award-winning, flavored air device that does just that. Instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. Instead of vapor, Fume uses flavored air. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses all-natural, delicious flavors.
Fume is a habit you're free to enjoy. It makes replacing your bad habit easy. Your Fume comes with an adjustable airflow dial, and it's designed with movable parts and magnets for fidgeting, giving your fingers a lot to do, which is helpful for de-stressing and anxiety while breaking your habit.
This award-winning flavored air device called Fume is like fits in the palm of your hand. It's around the size of a pen. Like Christy said, there's a lot of fidgety clicks, clacks, magnets, spins, and then you can also put it in your mouth and taste the delicious flavored air that comes from the little inserts you put in there. And you get all kinds of flavors. I got some white cranberry, I think was one of them.
Orange,
I like it.
Orange creamsicle or orange dream. And the actual device is a very pretty like wood color. So it looks very like nice sitting on your desk. Now they even come with stands so you can display it on your desk and then you don't have to worry about losing it. And it just kind of blends into your aesthetic. It's one of those things that no matter what your kind of style or vibe or aesthetic is, it's going to fit into your desk or wherever you're keeping it.
Right. It's just like when it looks good, it's on point and it tastes good and it can help you, like we said, replace one habit perhaps with another. So start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/creepy and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of the show 10% off when they use our code creepy to help make starting the good habit that much easier.
According to Dr. Mark Galanter, professor of psychiatry at NYU's medical school, the small group dynamic of the game made it particularly potent for coercion, persuasion, and brainwashing. Those who deviated from the group's norms were pursued aggressively until they complied with the community's values.
Well, it's like that quote of like, you gotta play this game.
And this is when it's not a game anymore. It's becoming a requirement to receive this quote-unquote treatment at this facility. Like, some people might just want respite, like a place to, like, crash on a couch for a couple nights where they don't think they're going to get, you know, harmed. And then it's like, well, if you want to stay here, you got to come to this meeting. We're all going to tell you what a piece of shit you are.
Yeah, they had like daytime meetings where they had to learn, like they would put a quote from like Nietzsche on the board and be like, or Henry David Thoreau or Ralph Waldo Emerson and be like, we're going to discuss this all day. And then you had to basically like debate, not screaming, but it's like an intellectual debate. So it's like now it was all about this like proving, debating. And I genuinely think it's because Chuck Dietrich loved that. He wanted to be the smartest person in the room, just like his AA, but now everybody has to do what he says all the time. This is like his dream come true.
It does seem a bit self-serving. It also reminds me of the Sarah Lawrence guy, Larry Ray, who just like wanted to just wax poetic and wax philosophical all night with these college students and would force them to talk. And it's you're doing this for the wrong reasons.
You're doing it for you.
You're doing it for you. And you're like masquerading it in this way, like it's beneficial and helpful for all. But really, it's just like a lot of the things you're interested in all jammed into one game.
Yeah. And also like convincing people at this point, it was all free, but shortly here in a minute to like give you money to do the thing that you want to do. All right. That's a good scam. We figured that one out. Thanks, guys, for listening.
We've seen that one a million times. The Synanon Foundation was incorporated as a nonprofit foundation in September of 1958 and granted tax-exempt status in 1960. While the Synanon program was technically free, new residents were encouraged to donate as much money as they could to help keep the organization operating. Though if someone had no assets, they weren't turned away. With very little revenue, the residents ate lean and solicited donations for food and basic needs. Residents spent all their time together, both socially and while hustling up necessities for the group. Daily morning meetings began with the Synanon prayer, which was adapted from the writings of St. Francis.
Please let me first and always examine myself. Let me be honest and truthful. Let me seek and assume responsibility. Let me understand rather than be understood. Let me trust and have faith in myself and my fellow man. Let me love rather than be loved. Let me give rather than receive.
Well, there's a lot of nice things in there.
Yeah, I mean, he stole a lot of good, like, text. Like, Emerson was great. He had a lot of great quotes from Emerson and Thoreau. It's just that he was like, and then also scream at each other and give me all your money.
Yeah.
That's another part of it. But he, I think, framed this up as... That's why the book is called A Tunnel Back, because he said Synanon is a tunnel back to the human race. And in the first like 2 or 3 years, he was like, you're going to get in here. We're going to help you save money. He talked about like they gave a lot of their money to us to operate the facility, but we encouraged them to have savings accounts and we would have them get jobs and we would help them figure out, okay, here's how you're going to get a car. And within 2 or 3 years, he'd be like, my kids will be able to graduate. And you're like, my kids, they're not your kids. You have
also,
kids. Go be a dad.
Yeah, your actual kids might have something to say about that, who you never see at this point. In August of 1959, the Ocean Park building was condemned and bulldozed after multiple code violations. Seeking a new home, Chuck and his fellow 65 members moved into the former National Guard Armory building located on the beautiful Santa Monica beachfront. For rent of $500 per month, they had plenty of space for all residents and a large enough kitchen to feed them all cheap meals. Though Chuck didn't have the revenue yet to support the venture, he believed it would come. His new neighbors in this nicer part of Santa Monica weren't very welcoming. The concept of a residential treatment facility for substance use problems didn't exist in the 1960s. Drug addiction was seen as a moral failing, and the common belief was once a drug addict, always a drug addict. Plus, Santa Monica was still racially segregated, and Synanon's willingness to admit anyone, regardless of race, also upset residents. The armory's location directly on the beach meant all residents of any race had full access to the beautiful coastline, while the beach remained segregated in other areas. Angry neighbors campaigned against Synanon, upset that an integrated facility for dope fiends was in their backyards.
The other thing about Synanon is it's always like, they do something, they're like, we're here for racial integration, we like interracial marriages, and I'm like, great, me too, and then they do something else, and you're like, I don't agree with that, or like, we want to treat people who have substance use problems as humans that deserve kindness and love, and I'm like, yeah, and they're like, and also should give us all their money. I'm like, oh no.
There's a, you know, like with any... beginning of a cult, there's all these good things that you're like, yeah, we all agree with that. I mean, that's how everybody gets drawn in, and then things start to unravel a bit.
But yeah, I imagine if you got like a nice beachfront house, and then they're like, without knowing like that the Synanon residents were actually very peaceful, they didn't like cause trouble. The problem is that like if someone wanted to quit and then like went right out there on the street. But the crime rates and drug rates were what they were. Synanon didn't bring crime or drugs there, but they were like a big-ass building you could point to and be like, that's why there's hypes everywhere.
Yeah. Within months, enough residents complained that the city brought an enforcement action. Chuck believed the group was being unfairly persecuted. A 5-month-long trial began in October of 1959, with Synanon and its board of directors facing charges of running a hospital without a license and related zoning violations. After 3 years of appeals, Chuck was finally convicted and sentenced in October 1961. He was given two options: probation, conditioned on his stepping down from Synanon and it vacating the premises, or jail. Chuck chose jail in a move that positioned him as a martyr in the eyes of the group's residents. He was sentenced to 90 days, but was released in 25. During his time away, member and Chuck's girlfriend, Betty Coleman, stepped up and kept the group running. Residents grew even closer with this new us-versus-them mentality, feeling persecuted by both outsiders and the local government.
And this drug on and on, but they had this trial where they would have UCLA psychologists coming in and saying, like, Synanon is great and it's changing lives. Then they had allegations from certain parts of the neighborhood didn't like them because of, you know, potential crime. Other parts was like, people standing around in a circle talking about their feelings sounds like communists to me. And I was like, all right, not everything is communist.
But you're one, like, also, are they talking about their feelings? They're really just screaming at each other, which kind of maybe that's more like communism because they're all just sitting around really angry and yelling at each other.
Right. And then they would have former members come in a negative way and say, well, actually, it's not just a rehabilitation facility. There's a bunch of sex stuff going on.
Oh.
Including just allegations that sexual relations were a regular part of treatment. Recovering, those in recovery were urged to participate in sex acts with members of the opposite sex to, like, get closer. They said that Chuck controlled all sex acts between even married couples, that the board of directors and Chuck had to approve it, and that they had... I know.
Imagine going to him...
submit a form? Being
like, tonight,
I'm trying to fuck.
I'd like to have sex with my husband. Is that okay? And he's like, tell me how you're going to do it. And you're like, okay, again, this is
no
self-serving. This is no longer like we're trying to help people. It's like we're trying to get people's deep, dark secrets that, you know, for our own control. Self-gratification and control.
And yeah. Gratification. I think he loved it. But they said they had a quote-unquote TV room with this broken television and a... in it, so that whenever psychologists or politicians would come and tour, they would be like, and this is our TV room. The TV's broken right now, but it's no big deal. Anyways, okay, we're going to take you over here. But secretly, the TV room was like the fuck room.
The smush room?
And the smush room.
And you had what they called it in Jersey Shore?
They had a smush room and you had to make an appointment.
Oh.
Yeah.
You got to sign up for the smush room.
The smush room's booked.
Sometimes it's booked and you got to wait your turn.
You got to wait that. Chuck said, absolutely not. That would never happen. Quote, we're not that stupid. But I don't know. He seems like he was pretty loose with stuff and pretty controlling.
Stupid or not, I think you get a group of a bunch of consensual adults together. Things are going to happen. Relationships are going to form. I mean, it's human nature. So it's not surprising that goes on.
I'm fine with that. I think that some would say if you're in certain stages of treatment, you shouldn't be engaging in romantic relationships because it gets in the way. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm okay with everyone hooking up if they want to. Mm-hmm. The part that I don't like is him having control over it and you having to get permission. Again, like he is a leader, a deity, someone, you know, a dad.
Yikes.
A dad that you got to go ask if you can have sex.
Yeah. And someone alleged there's like a lot of mentions of like Oedipal complex and stuff in the group. So they were basically framing it. Some of the angry neighbors at the trial were framing it as like, there's weird sex stuff going on in here. They're telling us it's like helping people kick their addictions, but we think it's probably more. And guess what? They weren't wrong. I mean, even if the sex specifics weren't spot on, it was more than just rehabilitation. Sinisterhood will be right back.
Politicians across the country, including John F. Kennedy, were defending Chuck and praising Synanon as a miracle. Its reputation as a new cure for the scourge of drug addiction began attracting celebrity attention. Guest speakers included Twilight Zone creator Rod Serling, author Ray Bradbury, and original host of The Tonight Show, Steve Allen. Other celebs stopped by, like Star Trek actor Leonard Nimoy, Jane Fonda, Charlton Heston, and Milton Berle. Chuck's arrest garnered donations from its celebrity supporters. The governor of California even signed a bill that exempted the group from registration for providing addiction treatment. Corporate donors chipped in as well, including Chrysler and Dow Chemical.
Man, Chuck was good. He knew to get celebrities. You're in California. Gotta get
true.
The celebs.
Yeah, and a lot of celebrities that were struggling with their own addictions would also go there. They had a certain dance move.
Called the hoopla.
The hoopla. The Synanon hoopla. And these famous jazz musicians at the time who were struggling with their own addictions would come there and then just play.
Yeah.
And so you have this private concert. So everybody's just up and dancing, and the hoopla would be like, just let yourself go, whatever expression, and like nobody's judging you. And
yeah,
honestly, watching that part, I was like, this sounds a lot like improv, like a place where you feel like you can be yourself, like everyone's going to support you. Everyone, you know, somebody would do some crazy dance move and everybody would start doing it. And I can understand, having been in a place where like you want that camaraderie and that community, like how important and inviting that can be. So I get that, like, people would want to be there. And they started hosting, like, every Saturday night. They opened it up to the public. So it wasn't just...
It's the hottest ticket.
Yeah, you could just go. And I'm sure, you know, there's probably people that want to go and see what it's all about from, like, a kind of morbid curiosity standpoint as well.
And I think, too, Chuck was like, yeah, we're having this amazing famous jazz musician play every Saturday. Come hang out. Also, did you want to join? Like, don't you struggle with something? You've had a couple of drinks. Like, everything became recruitment. But he was a marketing guy. His original job was marketing and sales. And so the whole time it was like bringing in, he had the reason why the governor signed that bill, he had one politician that he convinced to come and visit and then explained it was so good. And that one politician helped him whip up support that he had a whole ass bill passed just for his organization. That's how smart and powerful he was with this whole like framing. He would just frame it as like this amazing thing. No one else is doing this, to get JFK to be like, we all should be as good as Charles Diederich. Like that, you did so, like you did something. He's doing something at least, right?
Oh, yeah.
But again, like the numbers don't back it up. He made all these claims that it was like, we have 90%, like there's 90% success. And like, no, you don't. Like that just was patently false. But also you couldn't really test it. So people just believed him. And like it was, the drug addiction problem was so bad that the state parole board, I think it was the director of the state parole board, said, I will literally try anything that's reasonable. And this is fine. Like the state doesn't have to pay for it. The people seem happy. They get to go to jazz shows. Like whatever, let them go there.
That's what I was going to say. It's, I think a lot of the success he found is because of the time that it happened. It was the first of its kind in a time where like people were like, we got this problem. We don't know what to do with. And then some guy comes along and he's like, hey, I got this new radical thing and it seems to be working. And I, you know, am a former addict myself, so I know what I'm talking about. And everyone's like, okay, well, let's throw all of our eggs in this basket for a while and see how that works out. It's all about like the timing with shit like this. Like, of course, now people, I mean, I don't know, some people would still be into this, and there are probably groups like this that do exist, but I don't think it would be as widely positively covered in the media.
Yeah, and definitely not as unvetted by politicians who are like, oh, there's a drug treatment thing. Oh, okay, just like, we'll just send everyone there now. And you're like, oh, you didn't really even vet that at all. Like, they just went, he said it worked and we toured it and everyone seemed really nice. And everybody there on the tours wanted it to succeed because that's where they lived. So they were all great on the tours and they put on a really great face because he had whipped up with this whole, like, the neighbors hate us thing. He went on to sue the mayor of Santa Monica because even though they were allowed to stay in their place, there was just the residents didn't like them. There was always complaints at city council meetings. And Chuck used such hyperbolic language. He's like, these nuts are trying to kill us. Like using terms like that to whip everyone into this very cohesive, like, if you know, you know, community. And it's like, Rod Serling stopped by last week, just saying. And it was like, well, now I want to be a part of it. And it's like, well, you don't have an addiction. It was like, it's fine. I just want to, can I come to a party? And he was like, yeah, come to the party. So you just get, it just starts getting more exclusive feeling that people want to join.
That us versus them again. Mm. In 1963, Chuck married Betty Coleman, a former sex worker who had once been addicted to heroin. The marriage between Chuck, a white man, and Betty, a black woman, was controversial and, though legal in California, remained illegal in several other states. In archival audio, Betty explained,
"The old man and I started going together. People were just in shock. I was a dope fiend and I was prostituting. It was an interracial relationship. We kind of made a statement to the world. We refused to hide our light under a barrel."
To increase revenue for the organization, Chuck began sending residents out to so-called hustling jobs. Residents would go to businesses and homes, explain how Synanon had saved them from addiction, and solicit donations. One former resident, Mike, told the Synanon Fix,
"People gave us everything."
The residents received items ranging from cowboy boots, soap, cotton, and sheepskin to live fish, Christmas trees, and a Cadillac convertible. So much beef was donated, they needed a full-time butcher department. People were giving them whole ass cows.
Oh, yeah. Like,
it was a wild time. And I guess, and they said, Mike said, you know, when you go in and give this spiel, like who's not gonna donate to that? Now, again, now probably fewer people if they were approached in this way.
More cynical.
But back then, it wasn't like as common. So, you know, I mean, somebody came in with this story and you're like, well, I got all these Christmas trees that haven't sold. Y'all want some of these? They're like, sure, we'll take whatever.
I have 5,000 live sardines. And they're like, all we'll right. Take them. In the Cinnanon movie, which we'll talk about shortly, he takes the phone call and he's like, uh-huh, all right, sounds good. And he hangs up and he's like, they're giving us 25 tickets to Disneyland. And it was just like, because people would do that. They would just mm-hmm. want to donate something in kind. And I think I can't remember if it was the second or third year, they took in $200,000 in cash, but $800,000 in donated services and goods.
Yeah, that's a lot. A lot. Mm-hmm. Hustling worked. Although the organization was an officially registered 501c3 nonprofit, Chuck told the company's chief financial officer, accountant Ron Cook,
I run Cinnanon like a business, like Gulf Oil.
Referring to his former employer. In just a few short years, Cinnanon went from its residents subsisting on peanut butter sandwiches to owning multiple gas stations and apartment buildings. All were staffed by Cinnanon residents, who worked for room and board. In 1964, the group opened a new location in West Marin County, just across the Golden Gate Strait from San Francisco in Northern California.
And so he was trying to open places in New York and Detroit yeah. and like having the groups pop up all over the world with the money and revenue coming right back to Santa Monica where he was at.
That's kind of how we've seen in most of these that like open up branches mm-hmm. and it's like, well, but it's all coming back to one person at yeah. the end of the day.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he lived all right. He lived pretty good. I think he was taking a couple million bucks a year.
Chuck touted Cinnanon's enormous success rate for the formerly addicted, claiming that 80 to 90% of participants remained drug-free after leaving. However, he avoided soliciting donations or grants from government entities, who often had stringent evidence requirements for such claims. For instance, a 1964 study by the New Jersey Drug Study Commission found Cinnanon's success rates were actually around 10 to 15%, in line with federal hospital programs. Former Cinnanon president Liz Masakian later testified that 90% of newcomers quit within a year.
So yeah, again, you have these grand claims, and then when yeah. it's like, oh, okay, can we see the documentation? He's like, I don't want your money.
That's sus, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you can just make up whatever numbers, then, I mean, there's no accountability. How do you know you can't believe anything.
No. And that 1964 study I got out of, it's called The Light on Cinnanon, and it's by, we'll get to him in a later, a Pulitzer Prize winning publication, but they broke down every single number. And that was it was a study of 1,000 different participants. So it was like 1,072 or something like that. So it was a pretty good sample size as opposed to like the 50 or so mm-hmm. he was originally touting. So he's like, 90% of people, they stay drug free forever. You're like, I don't think to do.
No, and I think we've already learned that because you found out from the residents that are there that most people are doing drugs in the house,
like,
or going
there.
Out and doing drugs and coming back. So mm-hmm. I think a lot of people were not drug free, and he, you know, I mean, everyone in that position is going to lie to get the funding that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, Cinnanon received a flood of positive attention in 1965. It was featured in a productive light on the national TV program CBS Reports, further boosting public awareness and support. Later that year, a major motion picture called Cinnanon fictionalized Chuck's life and the group. The movie framed Cinnanon as a life-saving program. Academics, journalists, and psychology experts were all touting Cinnanon as the greatest breakthrough in psychology since Freud. In an era marked by the human potential movement, Chuck was front and center, providing a cheap alternative to other treatments. But soon, his attention shifted from these so-called dope fiends who helped him build his empire to wealthier members and increasingly violent intentions well beyond any rehabilitation. So what do we think?
Well, first I watched Synanon today, the 1965 movie. And
with Eartha Kitt?
First of all, I wrote my notes. I wrote her hair is impeccable. Her acting is a 10 out of 10. She is an icon. She plays Betty. Mm-hmm. Chuck plays, Edmund O'Brien plays Chuck. He was a famous actor back then. It was filmed at the actual armory. So it's like you see the inside of it. The screenwriter lived with them while he wrote the script. I would just like to say 100% it's propaganda. Nothing but propaganda.
Yeah.
This movie is centered around this main
Too
character.
Biased.
Oh, well, yeah. The main character guy is on, he's doing heroin, like very viscerally, like literally boiling it, shooting it up.
The one who's Chuck?
No. There's a lead guy that's kind of like Mr. Everyman, like Mr. Gotcha. Guy off the street. So he and his friend, they happen to overhear a meeting where Chuck says, like, we cure people. We drink a hell of a lot of coffee. We smoke a hell of a lot of cigarettes, but we cure dope addicts. That's what he says. So the guy goes, of course, there's a beautiful woman named Joni who's been 10 months sober. She's watching over him. She's like his owl shift or whatever it's called. And he hits on her relentlessly. He's like, I'm a great lover. And she's like, oh. And
he's like, we got to sign up. So the spots are going fast. Tell me what time you're available.
But then that's funny because it's like, if you come to Synanon, everybody's nice. They give you peanut butter sandwiches. Though she literally says, do you want a peanut butter sandwich? And he goes, no. And she goes, there's two kinds of dope fiends. Those that'll take the peanut butter sandwiches and those that end up dead on the streets or something like that. And she's like, they go right back to it. So it's basically like, get in or get out. Like,
yeah,
do
yeah.
what we're all doing. So of course, they end up sneaking up to the rooftop and banging throughout. Okay. I mean, he begins to like, the lead character begins to like kind of do all this stuff. Like he lets them cut his hair. He shaves off his mustache. He's participating. But then this guy, I called him Lurch in my notes. He was just really tall and looked like Lurch. It might have been the actor. I don't know. It was back in the day. But he rats her out to Chuck for fucking. And so the lead character and Joni get in trouble. And the lead character starts juicing, which is what some members would do, which would be to go to get cough syrup from the drugstore and would drink cough syrup with each other. So Chuck goes apeshit and yells at the guy. The guy ends up leaving. He then... Because he ignored the rules, he goes back to the mean streets. It's very much an after-school special. He's back on drugs.
Like yeah.
Sorry, guys. Spoiler alert for this 1965 movie. Joni comes in, and she's like, catches him. He overdoses. Meanwhile, Lurch was following Joni the whole time, follows in, and he's like, Joni, he's dead. Leave him. So she's all upset. She's also gone back to doing drugs because she wasn't listening to Chuck like she should have. So then she's like, I'm going to go turn a trick right now so that I can get some dope. How do you like that? And then she runs off through the park. Lurch runs after her. And I was like, this is menacing. I know it's for a good purpose, but he's chasing her down. But then at the end, she acquiesces. She goes back to Synanon with him. And the final scene is they're all literally in the room together, which is the actual room where they would play music at, singing and like swaying with each other. And it looks like the end of It's a Wonderful Life. And then the end card says, Chuck Dietrich spent 25 days in jail for violating a local zoning ordinance. 7 parolees living drug-free in Synanon were ordered out by the authorities, out on the streets. And the next card says, but Chuck returned to build Synanon into a national movement. Today, there are hundreds of people working and growing with Synanon, living because of Synanon. Mm. Columbia Pictures is grateful to Synanon for the opportunity to film this picture where it all began.
Well, that definitely sounds like propaganda.
It was all just like, it's a movie about what it's like. I was like, yeah. Nah, bitch. It was,
again, advertisement.
Yes, it was, Chuck was a genius. The mm-hmm. book, The Tunnel Back, was an advertisement. This was, so you can see why if you were just like a brush familiar with it, of like, oh yeah, I saw that movie, or like, oh, I heard of that. You would be like, they should stop. He's being persecuted. Mm-hmm. So then for the people that are in it, in this microcosm, they're like, see, everyone's on our side. Columbia Pictures made a film about us. This
John F. Kennedy endorses it. That's mm-hmm. what I was going to say is like the donations from like these big corporations and these celebrities, I'm sure that a lot of them were well-intentioned, mm-hmm. but also it's giving a little self-serving. Like everybody wants to jump on the cool thing, like the new trend, the bandwagon. And so it's like, oh, well, Lucille Ball stopped by because she would stop by mm-hmm. regularly. Well, then I got to go. Like, yes. You know, and then like it gets out to, we'll talk about in the second episode, squares, which are people that do not have addictions, but they just want to be part of the game. It gets out to them. It's like, Lisa Balser?
Like, what?
Okay. Well, I'll go down. I'll go down and get yelled at and scream if it means I might be, you know, rubbing shoulders with
Rod
Milton
Serling.
Berle. Yeah.
Like, I get yelled at if I could hang out with Rod Serling. I'll say that. That's my.
You'll take it?
Yeah, that's my, like,
you're,
level.
You're like,
if you told me
I'm just
Van
in the
Dyke
Twilight Zone. I'm just in the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, exactly. I'm disassociating. But no, he would take photos with them too. And so then in the entryway, there would be photos of him with all these celebrities. So again, you're just like, oh, I'm just here for like a Friday or a Saturday night, you know, concert. They also started in the early 1960s throwing these concerts at like they weren't at the Cinnanon House is what they called it. They weren't at the Armory where everybody lived. They would have concerts at like actual band shells, which of course the city got pissed off about, but you can't have content-based restrictions on speech because you're the government, First Amendment, yada, yada. So you had to let Cinnanon have these like benefit concerts. So then you're going to these like very cool benefit concerts. And that, again, we'll see in part two, even if you did not have any addiction, it became this like, if you know, you know, like, oh, you're a gamer too.
You're being the cool club.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's...
Because of marketing, because he framed it as being a cool place. He turned a drug rehab place into like a cool club that everybody wanted to join.
It reminds me of, I can't remember what Chuck Palahniuk book, where it's like the rich people get their kicks by going and dressing as unhoused people, people experiencing homelessness, and then like living on the streets because... that they're so rich that like that's how they, it's like the most dangerous game. It's like, well, when you have everything, what are you gonna do? I'm gonna hunt a man.
Yeah,
you know. And it's like, oh, okay, well, this is the cool thing to be doing right now. Well, then, okay, we're all gonna be involved in this, even though like no one's really like sussed it out to see how legit it might be. You just kind of hear like, oh, well, if JFK is supporting it, it's gotta be great.
That's a good point. It's giving Coney 2012 vibes, where it's like perhaps there's like a real underlying cause, but it's sort of been like bogarted by a person for like personal gains, like and it's been made to be this like hip thing that people don't even go read past the headline of like, this place saves lives and helps people, today is the first day of the rest of your life, and you're like, oh my god, it saves lives and it helps people, I should give them $1 million, which one woman later did, like because she, I think she was like the heiress to something. But it's like you get so wrapped up in the story of Cinnanon, which is propaganda based from the movie, from the books, from the interviews on CBS. Like, he would just be very like different than anybody you would think of a psychologist as, of like, normally when they would be on these daytime shows, it was like, oh, I'm gonna tell you da da da. You have this boisterous guy out talking, everyone's like, that's very different. I saw advertisements for specials about it on like the equivalent of what would be like the Kelly Clarkson show or like a daytime talk show, the, you know, Phil Donahue style, but in the 60s, it was Jack Linkletter, of like a two-part series. And Jack Linkletter was like billed as like the daytime show for housewives. So talking about how great this was, some housewife in Kansas is like, Cinnanon, that's the place that helps people. They're so great. And you don't know what's actually going on.
Yeah, it seems like with the heiress thing too, that's, I mean, we saw that with NXIVM. Mm-hmm. We see, like, with Scientology, they want celebrities to be, like, their spokespeople and the face of their whole thing. So then it's like, oh, well, Tom Cruise is in it? Then, well, I want to be it. John Travolta's part of it? Well, I want to be part of it, too. And it becomes, like, I think for a lot of people that donate, it's, like, almost like it scratches that itch of you wanting to be a savior.
Yes. And part of the Cinnanon program was that you had to go out on speaking engagements. So they would coach you, Chuck particularly, but then became like this crew of people, would coach you to go out to like the Rotary Club, the PTA meeting, colleges, universities, to talk about how great Cinnanon was and how it changed your life. So like you said, again, the Rotary Club's like, oh, we're going to do that bake sale fundraiser and we were going to give it to the Boy Scouts, but don't you think we should do it, Cinnanon, that man that came and spoke with us about how they're doing? Drugs are such a problem now and Cinnanon's the only one doing anything about it because they were coached to say that in their speech. So you're exactly right. Are we doing altruism for altruistic sake, or because it is the hot popular thing, and then also you get the feel good about like, but also I'm helping too, but it's also the thing that Lucille Ball does, so it's cool.
I think it's a little from all of that, but it gets real, the waters get real muddy when you got that many things dumped into it.
Well, this is the swinging 60s of Synanon is pretty much, it swings a little bit more in part two, but then we're taking a hard left in part two.
We're getting into the Synan 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
In part two.
Yeah, swinging 60s, Synan 70s, and boy, did they sin in a multitude of ways. So they stay tuned sure for that.
Yeah, and in the meantime, go check out the Max docuseries if that's available to you. And then the other one on Paramount Plus is called
Born into Synanon.
Born in Synanon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. She's a great filmmaker.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all eye-opening. And my favorite type of documentary is one that's a mixture of archival footage that shows exactly what was happening with whatever topic the documentaries about, mixed in with present day interviews reflecting back on their time. And that's what this whole docuseries is. And it's wild to see like this footage of the game and how people were living and everything, because it's not just somebody telling you the story. You're seeing it with your own eyes. Like, this is how it was. Like
firsthand.
It's not, yeah, it's not exaggerated how these things went.
No, we like an egotistical cult leader who's like, film all of this. It'll be great. Film
it. Get it all on tape.
Not understanding that he's like, create some evidence for later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
no.
Yeah.
Did not have that type of foresight for sure. Well, we will bring you part two next week.
Oh, people always ask. It's probably three parts.
Oh,
maybe,
yeah, because I know,
four,
I know a lot of people like to binge them, but I think we'll do it in three.
Yeah.
I think we'll do it in three, but yeah, at least three. So if you're trying to save them all up,
we'll see you in a
your
few.
Answer. Well, if you like our free episodes, you'll love our Patreon bonus content. You can join for free to see what we're up to next, and you also get once a month archival bonus content.
Just
came
out.
Signing up. Yeah.
And it's, let me just briefly say, fucking go to Patreon this second. It's one of the worst ones we've ever, most
Which
bizarre.
Which one is it right now?
It's the one of the food tampering ones, but it's
oh my God.
Bananas. So it's, yeah.
When we pulled it about those too often. Like, yeah. Those are some things that I wish I could unhear.
Yeah, but also, but you want to hear it and be
but
a part of it with
know.
It. Yeah, you want, you know. Have to know. So instead of going to Reddit and reading it yourself, listen to us on the journey and we'll all go on the journey together. I might go and re-listen just so I hear it again like it's the first time, but it's completely free. It's not even like a free trial. You have to put your credit card in. That's just, you got to punch in your email, but then you download it and it's all that plus the other throwback stuff we've let out.
You can also join at one of our tiers to dive into over 800 hours of bonus content.
Mm-hmm.
And like Heather mentioned, we have a deal going right now. We're offering free trials. You can join for a week totally free. You can join at any level. Check out all the perks and just cancel anytime before the trial is over and you don't get charged. Or if you like what you see and you want to stick around, you can do that too.
Yeah, get that annual membership because you get 1 month free and then you'd have a week free. So that's like 5 weeks free. And you get all those ad-free episodes, our monthly Q&As, our quarterly bonus content live stream. We get the weekly audio bonus content. We have some, I've got a real wild Ask Reddit thread coming up for y'all. We got True Crime Headlines coming up. And our monthly minisodes, merch discounts for getting into it and ruling the airwaves members, and the best listeners on the internet. Shout out to the chat crew and your buttons.
Oh, I love y'all all. And for recent patrons, thank you so much for supporting the show. And make sure you stick around after our sign-offs to hear your shout-out.
Head over to sinisterhood.com and click shop in the top banner to check out our merch like t-shirts, mugs, totes, stickers, and even clothes for your kiddos. You got that all new Believe and Be Kind shirt, as well as our merch clearance sale where we're getting rid of the very last tiny bit of our 2023 shirts to make room for 2024 full moon energy shirts.
Please take them.
Yeah,
please take them.
Go get them.
So we can stop saying that they're there.
We actually need to ask because what if they're sold out? I need to go ask how many we have left.
Okay, maybe they are, and then we can, because at this point, I'm just going to buy them because we got to get the new shirts
2024,
in,
baby.
2024. And next time, we aren't going to have years on our
tour
shirts.
No, we're going to just go full moon.
We're just going to have just the, and we already know what the subject of our next tour is going to be. So we're good, which that is a story for another time when Heather and I
can't wait.
Performed a miracle
yes
in front of Paris and Tommy and then we later were like, I don't think y'all appreciate it.
A miracle fucking happened, and I wanted you to acknowledge it. I felt like Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction. A miracle happened, but that's all for our 2025 tour, which we've got cooking in the hopper. But for Full Moon Energy, get your clearance deal right now and use that merch discount from Patreon as well.
While you're on our website, you can also review the show. We make it super simple for you to give reviews. We love 5-star ones. And you can follow us on socials. Check out the episode description for sources used during our research. And you'll find fun things like topic-based playlists and links to live show tickets.
You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at Sinisterhood Pod. Like us on Facebook at Sinisterhood. Check out full video versions of the show early and ad-free on Patreon. And then a few days later, free for everybody on YouTube. We got some clips from Freaky Friday coming up on TikTok. And if you want a custom video shout out for yourself, whether it's happy birthday, happy anniversary, or someone you love, head over to cameo.com and search Sinisterhood and order that for us. I'll dress up as a corn skull for you, whatever you want. I have a Blucifer head. I'll wear a Blucifer head with a Blucifer shirt, whatever you want.
Yeah, you got the whole outfit now.
Oh, where are you at on the internet?
I am on Instagram and Threads at Christy M. Wallace and TikTok at Christy or GTFO. Heather?
I'm across the board at Heather versus the world.
As always, the devil rules the airwaves.
Keep it creepy. Thank you so much for supporting the show on Patreon. Here are your special Patreon shoutouts. Lauren P.
Alana.
Catherine Troy.
Amy Hervey.
Mama Jerry.
Kim.
Tabitha Lynn.
Yvette Lopez.
Mindy Hector.
Jenna Long.
Sarah Hetsheimer.
Jamie Bennett.
Siobhan Cole.
Anna Tran.
Cupcake Riot.
Simone Patton.
Danny Stark.
Megan.
Christina.
Daniel Miller.
Maze Burris.
Christy, shout out fellow Christy, and you spell it like me, hell yeah, Christy Greer.
Alexander Provenus.
Kara Flynn.
Leonella Carpenter.
Sam.
Anastasia.
Natalie Hammerstone.
Shelby Compton.
Holly.
Bailey Dunmire.
Bethany.
We rock.
Yes, we do. Chelsea Elizabeth Lavigare.
Kelsey Fortner.
Jessica Duncan.
Christy Fuller.
Amanda Cimino.
Arowana Fauna.
C.
Sticks of Clubs.
Naomi Anhorn.
Victoria Levy.
M.
Alexa Bromer.
Amanda Ray.
Angela Hurd.
Bree Cassidy.
Sarah R.
Kristen.
And I groom dogs.
Well, that's very nice of you. We all love someone that takes care of doggies. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We love each and every one of you. We hope we pronounced your names correctly. Stay safe, stay healthy, and keep it creepy.
Mwahaha.